lowest ever maximum ice extent in the satellite record occurred on the 25th of February. This was 15 days earlier than average.
A grim report card on the Arctic from federal scientists. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Airlines tries another tact for getting around SeaTac's $15 minimum wage.
There is no serious person reading the Supreme Court decision thinks that there is still any room for doubt.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Despite its decision to abandon offshore drilling in Alaska this fall, Shell still has its eye on the Arctic. The company filed an appeal today asking the federal government to reconsider extending its drilling rights in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, which are set to expire by 2020. In October, the Interior Department turned down Shell's request to extend its leases in the region. The Bureau said Shell had not laid out specific plans for further exploration, a requirement for extensions. Shell bought its leases nearly a decade ago, but only managed to drill one full exploratory well this past summer, and it came up dry. The company argues its efforts were delayed by forces outside its control, including regulatory restrictions and court challenges. In a statement issued today, Shell said those arguments stand. But that doesn't mean Alaskans should expect the company to return anytime soon. In the same statement, the company said the appeal doesn't change its decision to end offshore exploration in Alaska for the foreseeable future. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration today released its annual Arctic report card, covering everything from rising temperatures on land and sea to sea ice declines and its impact on Arctic ecosystems and the rest of the world. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Since the beginning of the 20th century, the report finds surface air temperatures in the Arctic have increased over 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Jackie Richter-Menge is with the Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab. She says half of that warming has happened in the past 3 decades.
Between October 2014 and September 2015, the Arctic-wide annual average surface air temperature over the region was 1.3 degrees centigrade, or 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit, above the 1981 to 2010 baseline average.
That's the highest annual average temperature in the observational record since it began in 1900. Generally, Richter-Menge says air temperatures in all seasons were above average in the Arctic this year, with some reaching nearly 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit above the baseline. She says it was also an interesting year for sea ice, and the changes correlate strongly to the increasing air temperatures.
In February 2015, the lowest ever maximum ice extent in the satellite record, which begins in 1979, occurred on the 25th of February. This was 15 days earlier than average.
And that record low maximum was capped off with the fourth lowest sea ice minimum on record in September 2015. Along with declining sea ice, Richter-Menge says the composition of the sea ice has changed dramatically over the last few decades.
In February and March, the oldest ice, defined as being greater than 4 years old, made up 3% of the ice cover, while new first-year ice made up 70% of the ice pack. 30 years ago, in 1985, the composition of the ice cover was much different. 20% of the ice pack was over 4 years old, and only 35% was classified as first-year ice.
She says these observations confirm a trend toward a thinner, more vulnerable ice pack. The ice pack is not the only thing made vulnerable by a warming climate. According to Kit Kovacs with the Norwegian Polar Institute, marine mammals are greatly impacted, particularly walrus populations, which are hauling out on land rather than sea ice as they follow the retreating sea ice edge.
This new haul-out behavior is raising concerns about the well-being of their young that must now make 180 kilometer long, that is 110 miles, feeding trips each direction from coastal haul-outs to areas of high prey abundance. rather than simply utilizing nearby ice edges as they did in the past.
Kovac says fish populations are also changing in places like the Barents Sea, north of Scandinavia, where rising ocean temperatures are attracting fish species normally found in warmer waters, displacing cold-water Arctic species. Impacts are not limited to marine habitats. Martin Jeffries, an advisor for the U.S. Office of Naval Research, says the warming Arctic is resulting in lower snowpack coverage in May and June and increasing water discharges from Arctic rivers.
In 2014, the year for which we have the most recent complete record, the combined discharge of the eight largest Arctic rivers was 10% greater than the average of 1980 through 1989.
The report says the changes recorded over the last few decades are clearly evident, and combined with projections of continued warming temperatures, we can expect to see further change throughout the Arctic in the future. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska Airlines and other plaintiffs are continuing their long legal battle over SeaTac's $15 minimum wage law. They've asked a King County Superior Court judge to set a trial date so they can present evidence about how the higher minimum wage would interfere with airport operations. KPLU's Ashley Gross reports.
The Washington Supreme Court ruled in August that SeaTac's voter-approved $15 minimum wage law applies at the airport. A majority of the justices said there was no indication the higher wage would interfere with the Port of Seattle's ability to operate the airport. But Alaska Airlines and the other plaintiffs say they didn't have a chance to present facts in court about whether that's indeed true. Cecilia Cordova is an attorney for two of the plaintiffs, which operate two bagel shops and a restaurant at the airport.
The Supreme Court left open the question of whether the ordinance impermissibly interferes with airport operations, and we're simply asking the court to conduct fact-finding on this issue.
There clearly is no question mark.
Dimitri Iglitsin is an attorney for the union-backed group that got the higher minimum wage proposition on the ballot 2 years ago.
There is no serious person reading the Supreme Court decision thinks that there is still any room for doubt.
In the meantime, Iglitsin says many employers at the airport have accepted the Supreme Court decision and are paying workers $15.24 an hour. That's the inflation-adjusted wage. Ashley Gross, KPLU News.
A liquefied natural gas tanker truck is being tested for possible future use by the Interior Energy Project. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority has leased the 75-foot-long semi-rig from a Lower 48 company for road testing in Alaska. ADA spokesman Karsten Rodvik says the tanker has more capacity than LNG hauling trucks currently in use in the state.
The design of this tanker allows it to be loaded to capacity, and that's the difference. The design and the way the weight is distributed.
Rodvik says the tanker truck was filled with natural gas at the Titan LNG processing plant in Nikiski and driven to Fairbanks. Rodvik adds the truck, which will also be driven to the North Slope and back, employs a five-axle design.
It allows it to travel within the weight limitations on Alaska roads. So, again, given the fact that it is a larger capacity, if the testing proves successful, it can help reduce the energy cost for the interior.
The ADA lead Interior Energy Project is currently evaluating two private company partner proposals that would tap natural gas from either Cook Inlet or the North Slope for shipment to the interior. The LNG tanker was on display for public viewing today in North Pole. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, translating a Yupik essay with traditional themes into a film.
Everything had a spirit. Everything was in harmony. And this is kind of like a code of living.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Well, each December, there's a spike in impaired driving-related accidents, so consider the real cost of driving impaired. Could result in a loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. The Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
The chairman of the Marijuana Control Board says the state is on track with its regulatory process work. On Talk of Alaska earlier today, Bruce Schulte said the state had to finalize regulations by November 24th and finished a few days before that date. Schulte says the next deadline is February 24th, 2016.
And that's the last date by which the state must begin accepting applications for the various licenses. And so far, we're on schedule to hit that deadline as well.
Schulte says there have been some sticking points along the way. One of the bigger ones was residency requirements for potential business owners. The initial idea was to use voter registration rolls, but the final decision was to use the same rules that govern eligibility for the permanent fund. Schulte says verifying legal residence is important to meet federal criteria,
which, if met, would basically keep the DEA out of our hair. And one of those was that we had an accurate way of vetting who is participating in this industry. So by having a solid residency requirement and knowing who's applying, that at least one of those criteria.
One of the challenges for Alaska will be access to mandatory testing facilities for communities off the road system. Marijuana will have to be tested for mold, residual pesticides or fertilizer, and to measure potency. Schulte, a commercial pilot, says that will be difficult.
Federal aviation regulations specifically state that you cannot carry cannabis in a commercial flight. The crew, the air carrier, cannot carry cannabis in that fashion unless it's legal in that state. So you would think, okay, good, we're solid, right? That's what I thought too. But no, there's a federal statute that overrides that says, okay, all those federal aviation regulations notwithstanding, if a pilot or a carrier knowingly carries these substances, we're going to revoke his license and we're going to pull the carrier certificate. So it's a fairly high bar. And, you know, as a professional pilot, my attitude is, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to lose my license. But that's the problem that we have right now.
Schulte says there is tacit acceptance in Oregon to allow intrastate travel, but he says Alaska Flight Standard officials haven't adopted it yet. He says there's also remaining problems with banking and the IRS rules.
There are bills pending in both the House and Senate on banking and IRS rules, and we'll see, you know, that getting that accomplished is like getting an act of Congress, literally.
He says the easiest route to solve these problems would be for the federal government to simply declassify marijuana and remove it from the Schedule 1 list. Anchorage resident Jane Stinson ran into local stumbling blocks. Stinson is retired and wanted to start a family business in the marijuana trade here, but she says finding retail space has been tough. She found a landlord who was initially willing, but then changed his mind.
He was uncomfortable because he was afraid of what banks in the city might do if he submitted a lease that had marijuana on it. So those are the kinds of concerns and issues that we're coming up against.
Stinson says she still hasn't found a willing retail landlord in Anchorage. While police issues continue to divide communities and make national headlines, the Sitka Police Department is trying to restore confidence locally after a disturbing video from the Sitka jail surfaced on social media this fall. The department's top officers recently gathered with tribal leaders and other Sitkans in a town hall meeting to discuss the incident and to share information about the department's guidelines regarding the use of force. About 35 people attended the three-hour meeting, KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The town hall meeting was the kind of conversation that many larger communities should probably have, but can't, because the scale of the acrimony and tension over policing issues in recent years has grown too large for a single room. But Sitka has a just rightness that allows people to speak and a cultural tradition of courtesy that allows people to be heard. Sitka's police force has undergone some recent changes as well. Officer Mary Ferguson, a Tlingit citizen and newly minted graduate of the Public Safety Training Academy, emceed the meeting. Two relatively new lieutenants, Jeff Ankerfelt and Lance Ewers, have years of experience, but share an attitude about public engagement that feels fresh. This is yours, speaking about the department's renewed push for body cameras on officers.
These things are great because they're completely non-biased witnesses to events that take place. It's a beautiful thing.
Body cameras were on the agenda along with recent cemetery vandalism and the department's newly implemented taxi voucher program to reduce holiday drunk driving arrests. But none of these topics could match the gravity of the tasing incident in Sitka's jail. A video of the 2014 arrest of then 18-year-old Franklin Hugendorn went viral when it was posted on social media this fall by a teacher. Franklin is an Alaska native from Koyuk. He was attending Mount Edgecombe High School at the time. The video was obtained through a court order requested by Hoogendoorn's defense attorney. Ewers and Ankerfeld explained that pressure to finally release the Sitka Police Operating Procedures Manual and to have the town hall meeting came from within the department. Alaska Native Brotherhood President Tom Gamble applauded the efforts of the police to improve transparency, and he spoke candidly about his own experience, echoed by other tribal citizens at the meeting.
The thing about growing up in Sitka as a young Native person, when you see those uniforms, it's very intimidating. It's very intimidating. And some of that, as we age, just never goes away.
Nevertheless, Gamble remained open on the issue of the Hoogendoorn video. "I can't say the video was wrong," he said. "I wasn't there." The Sitka Tribe of Alaska wrote a letter to the FBI asking the agency to examine bias against Alaska Natives in the Sitka Police Department. The personal stories of several other tribal citizens, like Stephanie Edenshaw and Bob Sam, suggested that relations between police and the Native community in Sitka have been difficult at times. But Alaska Native Sisterhood President Paulette Moreno believed that this meeting and the willingness of the officers present to speak openly about their interest in regaining trust meant that times had changed. She referred to Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt.
"I know he's a good man, and he wears a badge tonight. And I know in his heart that if he or anyone had seen in his experience a Native person that was treated unkindly by an officer or a police department or unfairly, that he would do everything in his power to stop that at that point. And I know a lot of people here have been treated unfairly. I know that there's a history in the Indian village, and there's a history amongst our women and other incidents, our elders with their sons and their families. And I just want to say that we feel your tears."
But the discussion never drifted too far from the Hoogendoorn video. The audience asked about the hiring policies of the police department and whether the city knew that one of the officers involved in the Hoogendoorn incident had been involved in a fatal tasing in New Mexico. They also asked about the taser and how it's used and how often it's used. Lieutenant Ewers explained as much as he could without going into specifics of the Hoogendoorn case, which might be headed to court. But not everyone was satisfied. Brent Turvey is a forensic investigator who came to Sitka 15 years ago and has since made the community his home.
"I hear what you're saying, but I have a very real concern that you don't understand that what happened is actually a problem."
Turvey has been a frequent and vocal critic of police practices on social media. He said he supported the department's efforts towards transparency. Lieutenant Ankerfeld, however, thought social media had created antagonism toward officers. Some of those feelings came out in this exchange with Turvey.
"We don't pay them very well. Collectively, we don't treat them very well. Okay? They risk their lives. And then they go home and they talk about the things they read on the internet that affect their children. We are getting death threats right now."
The FBI has not said how it will address the tribe's letter on racism when agents arrive in Sitka this month to investigate the Hoogendoorn incident. Nevertheless, there was sentiment among some elders at the town hall meeting that it had been productive and that open dialogue with police should happen more often. Tribal Chairman Michael Baines closed the meeting by thanking the officers and everyone who shared their stories. But he also suggested that the conversation isn't over. Baines said that if there was anyone in Sitka who has experienced a civil rights violation, the tribe wanted to know about it. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wants to keep you safe from the invisible killer. Be safe this winter and always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This is a message from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. For more information, visit cpsc.gov. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Data released by the U.S. Department of Education shows Alaska has one of the lowest graduation rates in the country. Only the District of Columbia, New Mexico, and Nevada had lower graduation rates during the 2013-2014 school year than Alaska, whose graduation rate was 71.1%. Federal data shows Alaska's rate has hovered around 70% since at least 2010. Nationally, the graduation rate was 82.3%. Brian Laurent with Alaska's Education Department says the state's preliminary graduation rate for 2014 and 15 is 75.6%. He says that's when the state no longer required students to take a high school exit exam to get a diploma. State lawmakers in 2014 approved replacing the exam with a requirement that students take a college or career readiness test. The commercial harvest of lamprey eels on the lower Yukon wrapped up over the weekend with just under 37,000 pounds harvested and sold. That's 7,000 pounds less than a quota set by the Department of Fish and Game. The commercial harvest of lamprey begins a welcome infusion of cash to village fishermen during the Christmas season, but the overall health of the lamprey population is a mystery. Fish and Game managers don't have a good sense of how many Arctic lamprey return to the Yukon each year, nor how many are reaching their spawning grounds. A previous attempt to estimate the size of the lamprey run using sonar was not successful, and other research methods are hindered by the fact that lamprey migrate under the cover of ice in the dead of winter. Fish and Game's Yukon River lamprey manager, Sabrina Garcia, says it's unlikely the department will have more information anytime soon, so managers will continue to rely heavily on information from fishermen.
As a manager, it's really hard to manage a fishery when you don't have an estimate of population abundance. And unfortunately, with our impending state budget cuts, it's going to be even harder in the following years to come up with projects and fund projects to get these estimates. So talking to fishermen on the river, getting their knowledge, they live on the river, they know these runs, try to get them to give us information on run timing and relative run abundance. That's what really helps us to manage the fishery.
At $1.50 per pound, the lamprey fishery pays out a higher price than any of the commercial salmon fisheries on the Yukon. Quipac Fisheries bought lamprey at three locations this year, first at Emonic, then Mountain Village, and the bulk of the commercial harvest occurred around Grayling from December 8th through the 10th. The lamprey caught on the Yukon go into a wide variety of markets, ranging from gourmet restaurants to bait shops. Juno filmmaker Lyle Hebert is making a film based on the essay Uyurok, The Way of the Human Being. The essay's writer, Harold Napoleon, gave Hebert his blessing to do the adaptation, but says it'll be a challenge to translate the message into film. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The beginning of Lyle Hebert's film Uyurok is a reenactment depicting life on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta before Western contact. The narration stays true to Harold Napoleon's original words.
It's verbatim because his writing is so poetic, and so I couldn't do better than that.
The reenactment conveys what the Yupik word Uyurok means.
Their spiritual beliefs, the way they viewed the world, everything had a spirit. Everything was in harmony, and this is kind of like a code of living.
Napoleon wrote Uyurok in 1988 when he was in prison for the death of his son. He says he was so drunk he blacked out and doesn't remember it. He says without any memory, he couldn't defend himself and pled no contest to second-degree murder. He never went to trial, and no matter how it happened, he blames himself. He started writing to figure out why he and so many people he knew struggled with alcohol abuse. Napoleon is Yupik Eskimo from Hooper Bay.
I have been baffled for many years about why we knew so very little about our own history and why there was so much shame about our own culture.
Napoleon is 66. He says he grew up in a very mixed up world, being neither fully Yupik nor white and Christian. In the missing pieces of his village's history, Napoleon says there was suffering.
There is also a lot of disconnect between parents and children, and that disconnect was not just personal, it was also cultural. And so as children, we were kind of not abandoned literally, but we somehow ended up in nowhere land.
Napoleon experienced abuse as a child and drank as an adult. While in prison, he read a lot about trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder in Vietnam War veterans.
Having never been to war and never experienced war or witnessed war, I found it odd that I would have the same symptoms as a Vietnam veteran. And not only me, but all the other people in my village had the same symptoms.
After more research, Napoleon learned about the flu epidemic of 1918. In Uyarak, he calls it the Great Death and wrote that it spread like wildfire, killing 6 of every 10 people and wiping out Alaskan villages. It gave birth to a generation of orphans, he wrote. Up until then, Napoleon says Yupik people had resisted Christianity and white influence.
But after the Great Death, there was mass conversion and people began to abandon, in a sense, their own culture. And in abandoning their cultures, they abandoned themselves. There was also born in them a sense of shame and guilt because what they were being taught is that the way they had lived their lives had caused them to die in such great numbers.
Napoleon says the trauma, shame, and violence he and others in his village experienced traces back to that time, and it still reverberates today. He says writing Uyarak helped him to understand his village and his family, the past and the present.
And with understanding, there came forgiveness. I had found a trail of truth through our experiences as Native people.
Napoleon says Alaska Native cultures are going through a reawakening, and he hopes Lyle Hebert's film adaptation of Uyarak will contribute to it.
If the young people become interested in their own stories, in their own history, then I think it will have done a good job.
Hebert says as a young man, he spent time in Hollywood and used to be egotistical about filmmaking. But Uyarak is about something else.
I'm hoping that people will be moved by it and have more compassion and also realize what Native Alaskans have been through and try to look at people like people.
For Hebert, Uyarak is a meaningful film, and that has given meaning to his own life. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Ashley Gross in Seattle, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council works to keep Alaska's halibut resource healthy and abundant for the benefit of Alaskans and our coastal communities. Find out how you can help ensure healthy halibut for Alaska's future at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Did you know the average cost of a DUI in Alaska is over $24,000? Well, each December, there's a spike in impaired driving-related accidents, so consider the real cost of driving impaired. Could result in a loss of your hard-earned money, your job, or worse, you could lose your life. Alaska Highway Safety Office reminds you to drive sober or get pulled over. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.